Episodes in accordance for the wheelchair audience. You don't want to miss any audio clips, cause we're providing information, tips and some tricks for every state and every nation. Someone can benefit, like, what's the best fabric? Should I get the Tiger's yellow carbon fiber palette?
Welcome to Wheelchair Nerds, a podcast to connect and inform people who utilize, prescribe, and provide seating and wheel mobility equipment. I'm your host, Angie Kiger. Before we jump into today's topic, a brief reminder that the information in this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not intended to be medical, billing, or legal advice. Now, let's get to it. Hey, Wheelchair Nerds, welcome back. We are so happy to have you. We are deep into season two and excited to bring another episode to you. As we've talked throughout Wheelchair Nerds season one and season two, we focused on various aspects of seating and mobility. We've talked about ultralight manual wheelchairs. We've talked about power wheelchairs, talked about advocacy. This time, I'm really excited because we're actually going to focus on an area that has been one of my primary focuses of my career for a very long time, back when I was working at the pediatric hospital here in the Washington, D.C. area, and also just kind of growing up population of folks that I worked with a lot because I have a cousin that has cerebral palsy. You guys have heard me talk about that a lot. So we're going to focus on dependent mobility. And what does that actually mean? Because I know a lot of times we talk about wheelchairs, our goal is to make someone as independent and mobile as possible. For some folks, actually propelling a wheelchair on their own or using some sort of adaptive device to drive a power wheelchair is not an option. But it is extremely important we set them up for success for when it comes to seating and positioning and also their mobility device, because we still want them to be able to engage in different aspects of life. Because even if they can't propel themselves or drive themselves, there are a lot of different reasons, whether it be clinical reasons, medical reasons for better posture and positioning to, hey, just engage in everyday life. And when you think about engaging in everyday life, I don't know about you guys, but I've got a lot of OT friends out there, my occupational friends, shout out. It's almost your month. We're recording this in March, but next in April, we know is OT month here in the US. I brought one of my favorite OTs on here. We have known each other for a number of years. I'm sure you guys have probably heard her speak. So joining me today to discuss dependent mobility and manual tilt, be the one and only Michelle Lang. Michelle Lang, who are you? What do you do?
Well, thank you, Angie. Well, a lot of the time I'm just doing what we all do, right? Trying to get the groceries, pay the bills, take care of life. I live in the Denver, Colorado area, and I've been an OT for longer than a lot of people have been alive now, which is kind of scary. I don't feel that old. I'm married and have three adult kids and two wonderful grandkids, so that still keeps me busy. And then the rest of the time, I do some education, some consultation, and also see clients a couple days a month in a clinic. Most of the clients that I work with and have worked with for a long time are kids. A lot of the adults I see are grown-up kids that I've followed since they were young, just seen them for a long time. But I have seen some adults as well. A lot of the clients I see fall under that cerebral palsy umbrella, but have, gosh, a really wide variety of genetic and metabolic conditions that I'm constantly looking up and have never heard of before because our diagnostic technology continues to improve. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at a lot of equipment because when you're working with kids and often looking at maybe the first equipment they're ever getting, you might be looking at everything from a mobility base to a seating system to activity chairs, adaptive car seats, maybe bathing equipment, all sorts of stuff, standers. So it's really important to look at that whole 24/7 need for this little person and their family. When you work with kids, you're working with the family. When we're looking at how they're going to transport that chair, we have to realize maybe there's four siblings sitting in the car as well. So how is all that going to work for this family? And important to look again at all of those hours because kids tend to spend a lot less time in their seating system in a day than adults, especially when they're really little. So I could work really, really hard and say, gosh, this is an awesome seating system and mobility base for this kid that they're spending 3 hours a day in, if they're spending the rest of their time on the floor in a rather destructive posture, that's not going to be helpful. It's going to kind of negate all that hard work we did. So a lot of what I do also is sleep positioning because we're really keeping in mind, again, that 24/7. What can we do to really support this little person's posture and to be preventative as much as possible to really prevent as much as possible those changes to the spine, changes to the hips.
Yeah, we'll have to bring you back another time to talk about 24-hour positioning. I know we've got some other great OT friends that specialize in that, Tamara and Leanne pop in my head, off the top of my head, are the ones first two come, but we'll definitely have to talk about that because, you know, we talk about kids and we talk about dependent mobility, even when we start to think about, like, as kids grow up, it was really funny. So I'm not sure if Cindy Petito listens to this podcast, but another OT friend of mine, my gosh, I'm talking about his OTs today. Cindy Petito, as you know her well, she's an OT from down in Florida, is now traveling the country doing, being a travel OT. But she had a lot of experience working with adults. And then she did a stint up here in the DC metro area, actually worked at the former clinic that I worked at for a bit. And she was working with children. And she said to me, she's like, wow, you know, as someone who primarily focused on adults in my career, I would often get these clients who obviously were kids at one time, have CP, and it's a congenital disability. And she's like, I'm now realizing that how early we have to start with their positioning and really kind of putting the pieces together and thinking, oh my gosh, like I'm having an impact on their entire life now that I'm in peds. And so when they do grow up and when they get older and are in these adult size wheelchairs and seating systems, that wow, it is so important what happened back. You know, for years, I wondered what was the story when this individual was a child. And so I think dependent mobility, it's something that has always been a passion of mine. I go back to when I was a kid, seeing my friend Susan's friends, going to the camps that she went to. The folks who were nonverbal, who were sitting in those big old chairs that a lot of people were scared to interact with them, those are the kids. Like I remember as a little kid, like wondering, I wonder what they're thinking, even though they couldn't talk. I did a research project in high school with my friend Kim Thompson, who is now a special ed teacher. We're in our 40s now, on augmentative communication, just because we were curious about it back when letterboards were cool. So this has been, like I said, a passion of mine. It's cool for you and I to sit down and talk about this because, you know, when you think about wheelchairs, it's not necessarily something anybody talks about or shows a lot, right? Like I feel like because these folks have such, who utilize this equipment have such impairments, people are kind of taking, you know, kind of like, I don't know, thrown off. I don't know what the right word is. People oftentimes don't, when they come on their case, they're like, what do I do with these people? What can they do? So
yeah. Oh, I completely agree. You know, most of the clients I work with are nonverbal. To be transparent, the clinic I work with is run by a speech pathologist, and it's mostly speech pathologists who work with augmentative communication. So I see the clients who require some positioning, who require all of this equipment. And then I also look at how they can access technology, whether it's the communication device, a power wheelchair, toys, just control the environment, all of that. So yeah, that's the heart and soul of the clients that I work with. And I think that when someone's nonverbal, it's really on us to be very mindful during our evaluation and just interactions with this little person or an adult who's nonverbal, to be patient and listen to them if they have an alternative way of communicating with you, like a speech generating device, but also to really watch that nonverbal. So if I'm doing, say, a MAT assessment with someone who's nonverbal, chances are they aren't using their speech generating device or other communication strategies when they're laying on their back on a MAT table, right? Mm-hmm. So I have to really, really watch and look for other signs of, boy, I think I'm really at the end of that range. Maybe this person is uncomfortable or anxious. I think that's another difference with working with kids. I am not very formal in my evaluations. My main goal is that this little person and their parents feel as comfortable as possible. I want them to do their best. That means I try to keep up with the latest kids shows and characters and stuff and dad jokes and such so I can keep this little person relaxed. And I speak very calmly and slowly and let them know what I'm going to do and tell them that when they're seeing me, there's no owies. A lot of the clients that I work with have so many medical appointments, right? Uh-huh. Someone's always poking them. Maybe they have to have a surgery, very many surgeries, a lot of invasive procedures. I want them to know this particular appointment is a no owie appointment. And I will often tell this client that they're the boss. I'm not going to make them do something they don't want to do. I think a lot of our clients, especially younger ones, don't really feel like a part of the decision-making at all.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think this goes into a whole discussion on How's it different to prepare for an evaluation for someone who's going to, say, use an ultralight wheelchair, be independent with propulsion, or is going to drive a power wheelchair and is able to verbally express to you, you know, how as an OT, I know you have had the opportunity to educate a lot of folks up under you, but if you've got a new grad coming to you, or even someone who's never worked doing wheelchair evaluations, and all of a sudden they've got someone coming on their caseload that they know is going to need a dependent wheelchair mobility device, what are some tips and tricks? Like, how would you help them prepare for that evaluation? I think it'd be kind of cool for both of us to go back and forth on that.
Right. I think that's an important discussion. So again, with the pediatric population, or perhaps with a client that for which the caregivers are really very involved in the decision making, it's important that we really use a strong team approach and talk to everybody. One thing I also think that is unique in the pediatric population is these kids tend to have a lot of people on their team. There might be private OT, PT, speech. There might be school-based services. Grandma and grandpa and even the dog might come to the evaluation. So there could be a lot of people in a room. And a lot of what I find I need to do is education, especially if all this is very new to the family, and try to build consensus. That can be really hard. And if I don't build consensus, then I think what happens later is once this equipment arrives, somebody around that table, whether they participated in the evaluation or not, is going to say, wait a minute, why did you recommend this? I don't like it. And then we have a lack of consensus, right? That's not fun. And we're not going to get done. We're not going to succeed in those outcomes the way we want to. So it's really important to, again, spend that time to discuss things. I spend a lot of time explaining to clients, to their families, their caregivers, just what is muscle tone? What is muscle weakness? What is movement disorders? Because often I find the families are very, very uneducated about that. People aren't taking the time to explain it to them. Or maybe it's the first time they're ready to really hear it. And I want them to really have a chance to ask those questions. I remember one little boy I work with has a great deal of dystonia. And I was talking to his mom one day. She was just at her wit's end. She was in tears. She just didn't know what to do. It was very hard to transfer him because of these large, forceful, unexpected movements. And she did not realize that his movements were not intentional. Mm-hmm. Because when she tried to do something like transfer him, they got worse. But we know that those movement disorders tend to get worse with anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. So she felt so guilty when I told her he wasn't doing this on purpose. So I tried to reassure her and say, boy, it sure looks like it, though, when that dystonia gets worse on command sometimes, right? You can say to a client, show me those movements, show me that tone. And many clients can elicit that when they want to, almost on demand. Or we can trigger it, right, by talking about something really exciting. So it seems volitional. And it was important for her to understand it wasn't, and understand that just like we can maybe trigger that for a client, because we want to see perhaps if a seating recommendation is really helping by seeing if it continues to work when the client's excited and extending and moving, you can also help calm that. So I instructed her, when it's time to transfer your son, try to be really calm. I know it's hard. He has two other brothers and there's a couple dogs in the house and there's so much going on. But calm down and say, hey, I'm going to transfer you now. I need you to just relax, make your body soft, and also give her some basic handling instructions, like fold him up like a taco. It will really help. Control his tone, move him slowly to the next surface, and then unfold him slowly too, because that can feel really scary. And that helped a lot for her overall understanding and just making something like transfers easier in their life. So that education is really important. And again, I think just building consensus among people in the room.
It's huge. I mean, I can remember, you know, the first things. I mean, we're all taught this, right? When you do a wheelchair evaluation, the first thing is you need to ask people what their goals are. I would often make sure, and I would make it blatantly clear to the families, no matter how old the individual was, what I believe their intellectual abilities were. I once had a grandma say to me, "Oh, baby, why are you talking to him? You're not gonna get blood from a turnip." And I said, "Well," I said, and I was just speaking about her grandson because she knew that he was nonverbal. And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I understand." I said, "But at the same time, I don't know what he's hearing." And I said, "I know his eyes are closed. I know that, you know, He doesn't often open his eyes to engage with us, but in all honesty, I have no idea what he's thinking or processing. So I was like, this is his wheelchair, so I'm always going to engage with him. And right. even when I'm showing colors or, you know, trying to make a decision, I will hold up the colors on, you know, as big as I can get them. Like I used to take, is now working for a manufacturer, which is funny because I'm sure our graphic designers are like, you did what? I would take up the brochures, the color brochures, and I would cut them up because I would take all the little tiny like rectangles. Because you know full well, Michelle, no one that has a lot of difficulty with fine or gross motor is going to be able to point to one little color. I would like, I'd make bigger, like put them on index cards, like put a bunch
or
of them
together.
Or
even see it, right?
Yeah,
even
exactly.
See it well. Yeah, and a lot of visual issues.
I would make them, I'd present the two, like we could narrow it down and I would present them. And even if the child wasn't visually attending or whatever, I would show them like, these are the two, this is what mom and dad think that you want, or this is what grandma thinks you want. So we're going to choose between these two. And every mm-hmm. once in a while, you would see a reaction. And we had a situation one time where there was actually a child who was negatively reacted to a color, and it took us forever to figure it out. And guess who the person that knew what color the child actually liked? The speech therapist. Why? Because the speech therapist had been working with him on different skills and was able to elicit that out of him. So, right. you know, it's fun that you mentioned speech therapist, because I think I'm going to, during the Better Speech and Hearing Month in May, I want to try to find a speechie that really focuses on all calm and talk about the wheelchair evaluation process, because I think a lot of people, a lot of therapists, parents, folks who are providers forget or don't know what information a speech therapist has that they can give you when it comes to a seating position eval. Another thing for me, like I think back to the days when I worked in clinic a lot and when I was doing clinical education, I would always tell people, when you walk in to an evaluation or go to pick up your client from the waiting room or wherever, just stand back and don't say a whole lot. Just see how are they reacting. You know, Michelle, because you've heard me talk about a lot, cerebral visual impairment or cortical visual impairment. We're moving right. now in the world calling it cerebral. It was one of my passions because I had a number of kiddos that had that diagnosis. And maybe we'll do another podcast on that. But because of that, you know, visual impairment, it goes hand in hand with brain injuries, thus CP, which also leads us to the whole dependent mobility discussion too. You know, I would really pay attention to where are they looking? Why are they looking? I'd want to know what their visual field was, because if we put them in the old classic 90-90-90 position, right, but they can't see straight on, but that TV is straight on ahead of them, in front of them, and they're starting to turn and, you know, and move their body in all sorts of different directions, it's likely not because they're being defiant. It's likely right, not because right. they just don't know what's going on. They might be turning their body and to be able to see the TV and to be able to engage socially. The other thing I would also tell people, I also visually scan whenever they come into the wheelchair mm-hmm. assessment in. Mm-hmm. And primarily, right. I don't want to touch them. I want to see, what do they look like and how are they moving? Why? Because when they arrived to that evaluation, if it's somebody who's dependent for mobility, odds are they required a transfer. So their everyday caregivers have to know and understand how to put them in it. Because Michelle Lang and her skills can get somebody set up beautifully in a seating system in a tilt and space wheelchair, when you're waving bye-bye to them at clinic, they may never actually be positioned that well again, because the families don't have those skills.
I spend most of my time saying, okay, they're not all the way back in their seat. Let's mm-hmm. let's review how to get yes. them back there. And yeah. again, I think a lot of people are taught, just grab them under their arms and pull up. And mm-hmm. You've just given some traction to their spinal column, right? But exactly. you haven't necessarily budged that pelvis. So if they're in a posterior tilt, you can pull up on their shoulders all day long. They're probably still in a posterior tilt, at least the clients I work with. So if they can tolerate it, I'm much more likely to lean them forward and grab the waistband of their pants and give them a tug and just get that pelvis back up into neutral and then snug down that pelvic belt that's usually quite loose. And then that's education, right? So we'll stop and talk about how snugging down that pelvic belt is not going to cause pain. It's not going to cause pressure. It's not going to because I'm not strong enough for it to cause pressure. It's not going to cut off circulation. It's going to keep them in alignment with the support surfaces. If it's loose, they're going to slide forward and hang on the belt. And that's where I see redness. Is now you've got the front of the pelvis just hanging on this belt instead of the belt just maintaining that alignment. So again, lots of education, and one of the challenges, and I'm sure for lots of clients in different settings, but again, in the pediatric population, you have kids that have so many different people putting them in and out of that chair. And that mm-hmm. might include a lot of different people in a school setting. It's very hard to educate all those people, and there's turnovers, just like there is in other settings like long-term care. So hard to continue to get that message across of this is how you can tell. Or I'll try to give simple instructions like, okay, if it looks like they have way outgrown their seating system, like their knees are so far forward from the cushion, make sure they're back first. And if I can get them back so that the seat step looks appropriate, it's just in front of, you know, just behind the calves, then I'll tell them, look for that. If you have put them in the seat and there's 4 inches between the front of the seat and the back of their calves, then they have slid forward. It may not look like it because they're so flexible, perhaps in that area, that they're making contact, but you need to move them back. Or if their headrest is suddenly above their head, they've slid forward. Yes. I have people all the time say their head support needs readjusting. It's like, I don't generally have clients who shrink. So if the head support is suddenly above their head, they have slid down in their seat. So that needs to be addressed. And if we can't keep them there, then we need to reassess their seating.
Mm-hmm. So seating is, if anybody is just getting into wheelchairs, or if you've been doing this for a long time, hopefully you've heard it all starts with the pelvis. I mean, that's where we need to start there. And I think that primarily the focus of this podcast is about dependent mobility, and we're not going to get too deep into all the different seating options because there are a plethora, because really and truly everybody is an individual and you should look at every aspect of their body that is going, you know, be touching the seating surface, you know, from head to toe, literally. You know, this is a series of podcasts that we could do just based on seating. But today I really want to focus on the actual tilt and space wheelchairs or tilt wheelchairs. So one of the things that I know that you've been involved with for a very long time, advocacy, funding, talking to, you know, I jokingly say in the industry, the F word of our industry is funding. Because it really is a bad word. But, you know, help me understand a little bit about the evolution of dependent mobility or just tilt in general. You were telling me before about, you know, one of Resna's first papers, or was Resna's first paper you were involved with. What did that look like?
Right. Well, I think if you go way back, you could argue that all the first manual wheelchairs that were available when they first were coming out were really dependent because they were so heavy and non-adjustable. No one could push them. Yeah. Well, then people started, or companies, individuals started developing really much more efficient chairs in terms of weight and design for self-propulsion. But there's always been a number of people who, despite those advances, cannot self-propel any type of manual chair. And so those folks may benefit from power, like you mentioned earlier, but often require, regardless of whether they have a power chair, a manual chair. Because especially, again, the pediatric population, funding-wise, it's usually easier to get funding for a backup chair. It might be that it's required because the home isn't accessible, the vehicle isn't accessible, things like that. Now, if you have someone who can't propel any type of manual chair, there's a good chance this person requires more positioning in order to sit in an upright aligned position, because that lack of motor ability is related to perhaps what's going on with their body, either maybe abnormal muscle tone, muscle weakness, paralysis, etc. And this person's generally going to need more postural support. Someone who needs more postural support is also more likely to require something like tilt or recline in order to bring in gravity to better help their postural support in conjunction with the seating system. Of course, we know now that tilt has a lot of other advantages than just throwing gravity into the mix when it comes to supporting someone's posture. But I think that's where tilt began to develop on some of these manual wheelchair frames. You really rarely see tilt on a chair that's designed for self-propulsion because it's just a heavier chair. It has more frame adjustment available to it, and that tilt mechanism is going to add some weight. And it also can make the chair tippy. So depending on the design of the tilt, the chair might have to be a little wider in its footprint. It might need to weigh a little more than those sweet little ultralight chairs. So I think that's some of the development of Tilt. Another thing I like to think about is if this is a client who can use a power chair, or if they could, would be someone who would also benefit from a power tilt, well, then certainly they also need a tilt on their manual wheelchair. Again, in the pediatric world, I work with a lot of very young kids, so they might already have an adaptive stroller, or I might be recommending one. Almost every adaptive stroller on the market, as you know, has either a fixed or adjustable tilt to it. So a lot of these clients are already used to having a tilt. It's something they the family is using that they see benefit for, and so they want to continue that into that first manual chair that we recommend. So if the need persists from adaptive stroller to manual chair, then we'll go ahead and put the tilt, order a tilting manual wheelchair.
A lot of people will ask, and you know, I've done some research into this myself over the, pushing 30 some odd years of working on some of this stuff, still under 30. But anyway, you know, when it comes to tilt, I would hear this all the time when I would teach clinical education classes is, what's the right amount of degrees of tilt? Like, what do they need? What do they have to have? For me, if I was to ask you that, I think I know what you're going to say, but I'm curious, if someone was to raise their hand in a class, they're learning about tilt and space wheelchairs. Well, Michelle, how much tilt does someone need? How many degrees?
It all depends, right?
Indeed.
That's always the easy answer, but it's also true. So it depends on why you're using the tilt. If this is someone who is relying on tilt to shift their weight to minimize pressure risk, and they're at high risk for pressure, there's certainly some guidelines out there that are very specific in the recommendations. However, even those specific guidelines were designed for people with spinal cord injuries, not for other populations. So it comes back to, why does the person need to tilt? And then how often is that required? My preference, if someone's in a dependent base and cannot control their own tilt, because that's a drawback too of dependent mobility with tilt and space on it, is that very rarely can the client actually control the tilt. I think there's one chair out there, if they're able to reach down and pull a lever, they might be able to. But pretty much it's a dependent activity unless you add on a power add-on tilt. So since I work with a lot of clients who are nonverbal and they use communication devices, and with my OT hat on, I will often ask the speech pathologists I work with if they can add vocabulary that helps this person direct their care. For instance, something hurts. I need to get out of my chair. I need to be repositioned in my chair. But some of their vocabulary can be very specific, like, I need to tilt. Will you tilt me? Will you tilt me more? Will you tilt me less? Will you sit me back up? That's really, really important, because if I can not direct my care, if I can't tell someone that, wait, my butt is really hurting, I need to change position, how frustrating is that? I might just say, I need to get out of this chair, where perhaps I can stay, I can tolerate my seating system much longer if I could just tilt. So if I can't tilt independently, then I want to at least give that person the ability to communicate that they need to tilt. And how far? Because someone might tilt them further than they want, or not far enough, or they might just be stuck there. Now, with, again, if someone's at high risk for pressure injuries, often they're tilted pretty far back. Most of the clients I work with are at lower risk for pressure injuries, but still at high risk of needing help for postural support, managing their fatigue, maybe managing post-seizure fatigue.
Managing secretions also.
Yeah, secretions, huge. So things like that, eating, maybe if I do eat by mouth, I need to be at a certain angle. So that person might be using tilt for lots of very, very valid reasons, and definitely for comfort, because the clients I work with can certainly get uncomfortable, but are not likely to develop pressure issues, because I do work with a lot of people who have movement disorders, who have a lot of tone, and those people are kind of doing mini micro weight shifts all day long, because those muscles are contracting and releasing, and that helps with the blood flow, even if this person isn't making a huge weight shift. So this isn't someone who necessarily has to tip back 50 degrees and hang out. A lot of people who have conditions where you see abnormal muscle tone or movement disorders also have postural insecurity or reflexive responses, right? You tilt them back that far.
A lot of people don't realize that. It was one of the things I have had people who are verbal in power wheelchairs who have said to me, have you ever experienced what it's like to be tilted back to 45 or 50 degrees like you clinicians recommend. And yeah. I remember after I heard that, I thought to myself, you know what? Have I sat in a tilt and space wheelchair and had somebody else do it for me? That is a different ball game. So when I was teaching, if I was teaching a class on dependent mobility, I would have that as one of my exercises. It's like, you are, you know, Mr. or Miss Provider or Mr. or Miss Therapist, you do not have any physical disabilities. I'm going to need you to hop yourself right here in this tilt and space wheelchair. And we're going to have your colleague or this complete stranger that you don't know is going to tilt you back. And also, we would talk about this with home nurses. We talk about this with parents, too, because what will happen is if you abruptly tilt somebody and they've, you know, they've got that startle response, that can completely throw them off. It can scare them. They may never want to be tilted. They might all of a sudden you might have these responses, you know, verbal responses or physical responses when someone goes to tilt them because they are scared and they're, you know, they're nonverbal trying to say to you, don't tilt me. It's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Or don't tilt me that far or don't tilt me that fast.
Yes.
You know, one thing that is so awesome on power chairs, as you know, is you can program the speed of that seat function. So someone might say, yeah, I'm fine tilting, but I only want to go this far and I want to go slow. Or maybe I need to start off slow, right? So you can choose just the acceleration of it or the deceleration or the total speed. That's a lot of control over power seating because it's necessary, but that control isn't usually in someone else's hands on a dependent mobility base. And it's important to let them know, hey, when you go flying someone back. And I think that's an excellent exercise, Angie, because when you sit in a chair and someone tilts you as far as many of these tilt and space chairs go, it's scary. You feel like you're falling off the edge of the planet. And that's, for me, someone who does not have the same postural insecurity or reflexive responses as many of the clients that I work with. So I think it's something we need to be really mindful of. And maybe I need to start saying to the speech pathologists I work with, instead of just, I need to be tilted, I want you to tilt me more, is, can you tilt me slow? I really like that because, or don't tilt me this far back. You know, some of the tilt chairs on the market have a little gauge on them, right? That tells you how many degrees someone's tilted back. And I'm surprised how many of the families I work with will say they're usually tilted about 20 degrees or a certain amount. Because some of my clients really never come to upright either. They really need that tilt and they might tilt past that, but rarely forward of a certain point. And I've really been surprised since that became an option on chairs, how many of the clients I work with rely on those numbers? They look at those numbers. And if maybe if they're not even thinking about it consciously, if I said, what number do you never go past? They'd probably say, oh, we never go past this number because it's it scares them. And that's, again, why it's important to listen to caregivers, right? As well as, of course, the clients. Because if you ask those questions, I think there's a lot of info there that they may not otherwise share. But if I was to say, so do you ever tilt them forward of where they are now, say, oh no. And it's not because of castor interference, it's because the client can't manage their posture if they're further up oftentimes.
Yeah, you know, you touched a little bit on the power add-on of tilt. I remember the first time I'd heard about that because in the world of pediatrics, when we were working, the clientele that I was serving when I was working full-time in a clinic, it really wasn't something that dawned on us, whether it was a funding thing or what have you. But I remember there are three or four companies that do have that as an add-on that you can add on. It's whether it's a third party add-on or not. And I think sometimes people forget about that. I want to say the state of Washington was pretty good about paying for it. And there are a couple of little niches here and there, but it is an option. Not oftentimes talked about, honestly, because I think that the fear of funding, but if someone does have that ability, and that's the thing is, you know, we have a lot of folks from the U.S. that listen to us. And in the U.S., it's something that we don't understand. But unfortunately, our payment systems don't care about the caregiver. So even if tilt is something that, you know, a power tilt could benefit the caregiver to simply push this button and tilts them back, it's got to be for the individual. The client's got to be able to do it themselves. But that is an option that's out there. If you've never seen it, I always encourage people, like, call your various CRT reps and ask them. And say, hey, like, can I see? I just want to see what this looks like. Could it be right for the client? There's going to be some difficult, probably some funding aspects, but I think that's another option that people forget about. And then another, talking about power in dependent mobility, you can do, depending on the devices, but like those, the power assist options, like a smart drive. I've seen a smart drive go on the back of a tilt and space.
Right.
I've seen also power add-ons with a joystick go on the back of a tilt and space wheelchair for families. And that's the thing, it's been for caregivers. So it's been hard for funding, but it can be done. And I've had people who've worked in pediatrics ask me, well, why would you do that? And I think back to, we had a client whose mom was really pushing her almost 21-year-old teen son, who was much larger than her physically. She was really, he needs a power chair. He needs a power chair. He needs a power chair. And I need an attendant control, but he needs a power chair. And we're like, we're looking at him trying to drive a power chair. We're like, he cognitively and physically cannot drive. Like this is not going to happen. And then when we kind of drilled down a little bit further, it turned out mom was like, I can't push him. And that was where mom's thing. It was reality was that she knew that she physically could not push him. So
sure. Yeah. It's a common scenario.
Yeah. I mean,
and it is tricky funding wise, but now it depends on my mood and depends on the day, but there's a lot we can get funded if we're willing to really work hard on the documentation and not take no for an answer. Boy, if I took no for an answer, I tell you at with Colorado Medicaid, oh my gosh, I would be. But I would say that when I answer their questions or we appeal something, that we do get funding probably at least 80% of the time. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't go that extra step, which is hard to do, I can't charge for my time for documentation, right? And the productivity requirements of therapists is so high these days, depending on where they work, that I really worry that there might be less effort to keep going that extra mile. But if I never answered those questions, if I never worked with the team to submit some more documentation, it's really scary how little of what I recommend would actually be approved at any given time. And it varies, but it's really scary. So we have to keep getting in there. I also had a client who lived a little out of this area. Large guy. Parents are getting older. They have a very steep driveway. He needs to stay quite tilted. And it's hard, even with stroller handles and stuff, to push a chair when it's that tilted uphill, really hard. Those handles just end up being really low. And he's on a ventilator. So very heavy base. Parents are trying to get him out of the van into the house. Well, what we ended up doing, and fortunately the family was cooperative with this, we said, this is a tricky ask. We need you to find somewhere where you can take your son in his chair with everything on it. Anything you ever need to bring with you, put it on the chair because that's your typical weight. And weigh the whole thing. You might have to find a warehouse somewhere that has a big old scale that you can wheel this whole thing on. And their son, this is a manual tilt chair, the seating system, the ventilator, all the medical stuff they had to have with them all the time. I think he's on oxygen as well. Weighed, I think, about 350 pounds. That's about as much as a power chair.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And so those numbers are really helpful to put in the documentation. So I put that in there, that this family's trying to push 350 pounds uphill to get into their house. And that's not realistic. Because you're right, if I had said, this is really hard for mom, her back's kind of sore, and she might even need surgery if you don't take care of this. I think to most funding sources, trying to take the high road, they're figuring, well, that's out of someone else's bucket. That's not out of ours. Our bucket is, what does this client need? But if she is pushing him and hurts herself or slips, he could go flying down that driveway and be injured. And I've had that happen with some clients. And so that is something I can include in my documentation to help. And it took some work, but we were able to get him a power assist added to the chair with the joystick mounted on the back, and the parents would use it when they needed to. Pretty much, I think they use it all the time now because this chair really weighs a lot. It's quite large.
Yeah, I got a lot of people don't think about that. Another thing that I think that I know has been something you have been championing for years, and we unfortunately here in the U.S. got some not so great news about it, but I think we have to also talk about dynamic components and options related to dependent mobility. I know it's something you're passionate about because you've seen the clinical impact that it's had on folks, but when we say dynamic components to go on a tilt and space wheelchair, what are we talking about here? What do those actually help with?
Right. So there are available in the United States dynamic backs that move in response to hip extension, dynamic footrests that move in response primarily to knee extension, and then even hardware that can attach the head support so that when there's extension at the neck, that's absorbed. So it's used for a variety of reasons. It can help protect the client from injury, help protect equipment from damage, also really help the client stay in position. So when you have a client who is extending, let's say at their hips within their seating system, and I know you've seen this, we have clients who literally are standing in their chair. No matter what seating we recommend, they're still extending and moving far out of alignment with those support surfaces. So imagine that client who is extending within their seating system, literally standing in their seating system. They extend at the hips, their back collides with the back of the seating system, and there's nowhere for that force to go. Mm-hmm. So the client moves upward, and when they land, their pelvis has slid forward. There's just nowhere else for it to go. Or that person might just simply leverage right off the back and just push their pelvis forward. Mm-hmm. So it's a big problem in positioning, whereas if the back moves a little bit, it absorbs those forces, actually stores it within an elastomer, a spring, or hydraulic, and that force returns the client to upright, but without a loss of position. I always think of it as this, because I'm an OT. If I'm sitting behind a client on the mat table and they extend, I don't lean into them and try to win, because I will lose. Those clients, it doesn't matter if they only weigh 60 pounds, they'll bowl me over. Tone is different than muscle strength, so much different. What I do, what we all do, is I will lean back a little bit, let that tone relax, and then bring them back to upright. Just like we do that on the mat table, that's kind of what dynamic seating does within a seating system. And it can really help reduce overall active extension, reduce breakage, reduce injury, but also keep that client in position. And I find that a lot of my clients will also tolerate staying in the seat much longer. I recommend a lot of dynamic seating on tilt and space chairs because, again, someone who needs dynamic seating, for the most part, is going to need a more aggressive seating system, a more supportive seating system. And those clients often do require tilt as well. So it works really well, that combination of dynamic seating with a tilt. Another thing that makes me think about a little bit is we have different types of tilt. We have center of gravity and posterior tilts. When you have a client who's really wanting to rock, perhaps within their seating system, they're seeking out movement, or perhaps they're extending quite a bit at their hips, that client can tip over a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. So stability is really important. And I think for a long time, some of the strategy was, let's just get a bigger chair, bigger footprint, harder to tip, maybe it weighs more. But instead, what somebody eventually designed was a center of gravity or a rotational tilt, so that the footprint of the chair doesn't have to be as large, the chair doesn't have to weigh as much. Mm-hmm. So when the chair tilts, the center of gravity of the client remains the same. So it tilts within the space of the frame, whereas a posterior tilt, you just had some simple hydraulics at the back, kind of at the back cane to seat rail junction, right? And it would move posteriorly from that spot. And that makes the chair more tippy, especially if you combine it with someone who's rocking, who has a lot of extraneous movement, who's extending, and has that dreaded humongous backpack hanging off their back chains, the push handles, right? And I hear people all the time say, oh, just tell them to leave the backpack off. Like, you know, that's just kind of life, because the clients I work with have to travel with a lot of stuff. And sometimes it's just medical stuff. It can really take up a tremendous amount of room. And there just may not be room for that somewhere else on the chair. So it's really nice that we have those options of that more center of gravity option, so that the chair isn't as tippy and we don't have to rely on the chair being overly long or heavy to keep it from tipping over.
For sure. And when you talk about weight of a chair, that, you know, that's always the, gosh, the question I can't tell you how many times that we got from families who were, and I know you've seen this in your practice. You have an 8-year-old that comes in for an evaluation, and you've never met this child, but you're fully expecting them to come in, and they're 8. They're probably going to be in another wheelchair and adaptive stroller, but they're rolling in an umbrella stroller or a jogging stroller, because that is what has been the easiest for the families for transportation. So right. I think transportation is a little bit of a delicate dance when it comes to talking about dependent mobility, because I never forget, I have one of my favorite clients of all time who I will say, for those of you guys who don't work in pediatrics, for me, Michelle, this has been the only downside of working in pediatrics. It's when you try to figure out how old they are now, because in your head, you've got them pictured as this little kid because you haven't aged. But right. I know full well this girl I'm about to talk about was 4 when I started working to her is well out of high school at this point. But I remember she was going from an adaptive stroller to a tilt-and-space wheelchair, and she was dead set. It's got to be a tilt-and-space wheelchair that can fold. It has to be one that can fold. And there are options. There are absolutely options out there. We could take the seating system off. It's got a cross brace, fold up, fold the back canes down, blah, blah, blah. And the car goes. I remember her telling me, you guys are right. She's like, I did that one time in a rainstorm. It is not for me. She goes, it could be for other families, but that's just not for me. But the hard part is you really have to go over all of that with the families. And there are various ways. You know, I think it was my friend, Christy Shimono, who told me. Christy Shimono has been in the world of wheelchairs for a number of years. Product manager, just an excellent person who understands design of wheelchairs. And we used to be coworkers. And as we were chatting about this, she's like, yeah, but everybody thinks of folding as just that cross brace. She's like, but there's other ways to break down a chair. You know, there are chairs that have the cross brace where there's chairs we can take the seating system off. One of the coolest things I have seen, even though we are openly or honest to this is, you know, a podcast sponsored by ProMobile, but I didn't realize this honestly until PDG was acquired by ProMobile and I've played with it a little bit, is that there's like a take apart option, which I was like, well, that's kind of cool that you can actually take apart, decouple, if you will, the seating. I mean, it still weighs around 20 some odd pounds, but it breaks it down into 2 different pieces that a family could put in their trunk, which for some folks, that's a game changer. Other folks will say, we are never physically going to break this chair down. So I am not going to recommend a chair that physically can be broken down, because if they have a van, good to go. But those are just like transporting the chair, you know, back to that is a huge thing. Whether you're transferring the person out of their seating system in their wheelchair for transportation, or they're remaining in that wheelchair, it's another discussion you've got to have, is talk about tie downs and how just because the frame can lock down, what about the child? What about the individual? Because a lot of people get caught up in the, oh, well, we just tie the chair down. Correct. That chair is not going to move if you're in a car accident. You are right. That chair itself will not move. However, if you also don't have the proper restraint for the client coming from the van or wherever, that chair won't go anywhere. But we've all seen those videos or crash testing where the child and the seating system moves. So it seems like little minor things to talk about, but there's so many. It's called complex rehab technology for a reason. That's the industry we're in. And we've talked about a ton of different options related to dependent mobility, but really and truly, you know, we are scratching the surface in this podcast. And I'm hoping that they just kind of inspired some people to learn more. Hopefully we didn't overwhelm people, but just inspire people to learn. There are a lot of options out there. It is not cookie cutter. No piece of CRT is cookie cutter, but to really look at everything from the type of tilt, as you were mentioning, like, you know, is it a center of gravity tilt or is it, you know, tilt behind them? Do they need what some folks will call like a knee pivot tilt, where they just need to drop down a little bit for maybe some functional positioning and they still want to be able to use their lower extremities to propel? Another thing we didn't talk about is reverse configuring a tilt and space wheelchair. I've seen that, you know, where they put the big wheel in the front and little wheels in the back. So maybe the individual sitting in the chair, they're not going to push themselves in a marathon, but maybe the big wheels. I know the kid's name in my head. I always think about him because he was the first child I ever saw reverse config. And it was just so he could reach the wheels and be able to touch them and move around a tiny bit in his environment. Right. Mom and dad wanted him to have that independence. So there's so many different options to consider with dependent mobility. So I guess I would encourage all of our listeners to learn more. Never stop learning. Become close confidants and friends with all of your manufacturer representatives to learn about the ins and outs and all of them. I know that another great resource for learning, I've got it sitting, I'm not kidding you, it's actually on a thing right beside me, is, of course, this book might look familiar to you. It's hard to see with my blur on, but The Seating and Wheeled Mobility, A Clinical Resource Guide, is another great resource. Rumor has it you and Jean are working on a volume 2 of this.
Just every waking moment of my day, yes.
We're
working on edition 2. And actually, one of the chapters is on dependent mobility and goes into a lot of detail about tilt and recline. There's also another chapter that's completely on power seating. And even though it's referring to power seating, still talks about a lot of the clinical indicators for each of these different movements, why you would use tilt versus recline. You know, recline, manual reclines are not very efficient compared to power reclines. There's a lot of shear in manual reclines, so they're not used very much in dependent mobility, but tilt certainly is. I think another good resource is, you mentioned at the very beginning about the RESNA position paper. Many years ago, sitting at a RESNA conference, a meeting of the Wheel and Seating Mobility SIG, we got talking about things that we needed to do and decided that a position paper was needed on tilt and recline. And it was because there were a lot of difficulties with funding. Funding sources kept coming around. Sometimes they would approve this technology and other times say, you know, there's no research for that, so we're not going to fund it. And it was very frustrating. It's not practical for everybody who's recommending this equipment to have to keep re-researching everything and prove that it is a valid intervention. So the very first RESNA position paper was on tilt recline. It's been updated a few times, but it includes information such as, what are the clinical indicators for this technology? When would you use one versus the other versus even combining them like we do a lot with power? And then here's a literature review. Here's what the literature does say. And yes, indeed, it is well supported in research that this is an intervention that is required for a lot of people. And that can be a great resource when we're having difficulty with funding, or even when somebody perhaps is just asking for more information and support of an intervention. Personally, I haven't had to for a while, but I have had some times where I have had a funding source so stubborn about this particular issue that I have attached the entire position paper to my report and said, here you go, and try to divert the attention more from, this is just my opinion as the recommending OT, to your argument is with all this research and consensus that's been approved by an international assistive technology professional society. So you can fight with them. Stop fighting with me. And that will usually do it. Now, do they read it? I really heartily doubt it. It's very long. But they don't want to read this 30-page monster. And I think figure, well, gee, I guess there's a lot of evidence. We'll just say yes. So if you're running into funding problems or you just want some more guidance as to what are all the clinical indicators for tilt, whether it is a manual tilt or whether it's power tilt, that's a good resource as well.
Absolutely. Well, Michelle, thank you for taking time out of your very busy day. I know that you are a woman who still gets around, gets into clinic, hops on a plane, does live education. It's always fun. I haven't seen you face-to-face since maybe last year at ISS.
Probably, yeah.
Man, we used to see each other all the time on the road. It's kind of a bummer, but maybe one day we'll get to go tour the great Northwest again.
Yes.
And take a road trip again and stop for some seafood at a random place. True story. And tour the Tillamook Cheese Factory. Remember we did that too on that journey?
Yes, I think we have a picture by a cow.
Yes.
Not a real cow, but.
Yes. Crazy times. Well, I didn't put this in our list of potential questions, but this is something I always like to ask people kind of towards the end of our podcast is, you know, what makes Michelle Lang a wheelchair nerd?
That's a great question. I think something that you and I share, and hopefully a lot of people do in this industry, is first a desire to serve, to really help others, to make a difference, but also a value for the clients that we work with. Because I think that a lot of the people I work with can be intimidating for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So if a client I work with is hanging out by the lions over at the Denver Zoo, probably not a lot of people are going to come up and say, hey, how you doing today? Mm-hmm. Or are lions your favorite animal? They're going to give this person a wide berth because that person looks different than them. And I think we all have that tendency, but you know, we're not in junior high anymore. And we don't have to label everyone. And what's so addictive to me about assistive technology is the opportunity through that technology to get to know who this person is. It might be a little harder, but I tell you, there's really nothing better than to be in an evaluation or in a treatment session where perhaps a person for the very first time can say, I love you, to someone on their communication device.
Absolutely.
Or can move themselves and see their face light up. Mm-hmm. Because most of the clients I work with, and I might get disbarred as an OT for saying this, but most of the clients I work with, I could do more traditional developmental therapy all day long, and it's not going to budge their developmental milestones very much. Mm-hmm. But a power chair can provide independent mobility. A communication device can provide communication. Some of these strategies, and it all starts with a good supported position, can help protect this person's body from loss of range and changes to their spine and their hips, or at least minimize that, and help them just get out and about and participate in their family, in school, at work, in the community. And it's really a privilege to be able to work in this industry. What's frustrating, especially after working so hard in all this for so many years, is I feel that it's extremely, extremely important that we ensure that our field offers more to clients in the next 10 years than in the last 10 years, not less. And that is really a constant battle that we need to fight. And we, for any of you on this podcast, listening to this podcast, that are maybe just a little younger than Angie and myself, I would greatly encourage you to catch that fire, get that passion, get excited, because it takes a lot of passion to keep getting in the ring and fighting when for things that we really shouldn't have to fight for at all. So we need to keep advocating for this field and for our clients, because it would be absolutely inexcusable for our clients, again, to have less available to them in the future than they have now, or less innovation than we've seen in the last number of years. This is a relatively young field, and that has gone through amazing, amazing innovation. It's amazing what we have to offer our clients. To see that jeopardized at this point in time is just not acceptable, and it takes a lot of continued work. So we need to keep hanging in and encouraging each other and eating chocolate and waving the flag and not giving up.
Fighting the good fight. Yeah, that's why when I started at Permobil, one of the first things that Kayla, who you guys have listened to the podcast, hear me refer to our executive producer a lot. She's always behind the scenes. But one of the first things that landing pages we did together was advocate for more. We have a whole landing page that is, you know, not dedicated to selling wheelchairs. It's dedicated to helping folks know the avenues that they can take to advocate, because it takes more than a village. It takes an entire country, honestly.
Yes.
To be able to make these changes happen. So thank you so much, my friend. It was awesome talking to you. Maybe when you and Jean are ready to publish this book, we'll have you back on, because I was one of the people, people used to tease me, like, is Michelle and Jean paying you? Because when I would do clinical education events, I'd hold it up and be like, this is a great book, everyone go buy it. So I will happily market you guys when you're ready, or
well,
addition
thank
to.
You. So. We're excited about it. There's 8 more chapters than last time.
Wow.
There's a total of 55 authors. There's a lot packed into this resource. So,
yeah, I think our very own Amy Morgan participated again, didn't she?
Yes, and your very own Ginger Walls.
Nice.
And other folks as well. I'd have to think about it through my tired brain. But yeah, it's very much a collaborative effort, which is I don't want to see lost in our industry, is collaboration between different manufacturers, suppliers, clinicians, consumers, their caregivers. We all need to work together. And when we start getting a little too stuck in our box, like, well, I can't possibly work with someone I might view as our competition, then we lose some. The client is who ends up losing, right? Mm-hmm. And I appreciate when we have opportunities to collaborate.
Awesome. All about connection. That's what we talk about on this podcast. This podcast was created in order to connect people who utilize, prescribe, and provide complex rehab technology. So thanks again so much, and we will end this. Take care, guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Wheelchair Nerds, presented by Permobil. Today's episode was brought to you by...
Permobil is excited to welcome PDG Mobility to the family. PDG Mobility was founded in Vancouver, Canada in 1995 with the mission to design and manufacture custom wheelchairs for users whose needs were not met by existing devices. The PDG Mobility family of manual tilt wheelchairs include pediatric, adult, and bariatric options for a variety of different users.
Thanks for checking out this episode. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single one. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is @wheelchairnerds. And tell your friends about our podcast too. Oh, and we really appreciate it if you'd give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment sharing what your favorite thing about Wheelchair Nerds is. Last but not least, if you have a topic you'd like us to discuss or know a great guest, hey, it could even be you. You could be that next great guest. Send us an email. Tell us why. You can reach us at wheelchairnerds@permobile.com or DM us on one of our social platforms. We love hearing from you. With the wheelchair.